This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. In a few moments, President Obama will hold his first press conference since winning re-election. It will be his first appearance with news reporters in the East Wing of the White House since March. Traditionally, this would be a chance to revel in his recent re-election and lay out a second-term agenda. But Mr. Obama is sure to face many questions on the scandal now surrounding his national security chiefs. Last Friday, retired General David Petraeus resigned as head of the CIA, admitting to an extramarital affair with his biographer, a liaison uncovered through emails. Since then, officials have said they are also investigating thousands of pages of emails between Marine General John Allen, the top commander in Afghanistan, and another woman who is also linked to the Petraeus scandal. It's all very confusing and a bit soap opera-ish. Meanwhile, the so-called fiscal cliff still looms. The lame duck session of Congress convenes this week and faces huge pressure to hammer out a budget deal to avoid automatic tax hikes and spending cuts that would kick in at the end of the year. As we wait for the president, with us here in Studio 4B, NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, and our Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Hi, all.
Hello.
Hello, Jennifer.
Tom Bowman, can you tell us what is the latest? You've been following the news of General Petraeus and now the investigation into the emails of General Allen. What do we know today?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the Pentagon Inspector General is investigating some emails and other documents that General Allen sent to a woman involved in the case, Jill Kelly. Now, she's a Tampa socialite who has ties to the local military community. And our sources say there's no indication of a romantic relationship here, but there is a possible concern about maybe sensitive information being exchanged. So that's one thing. And along these lines, the FBI has brought out a computer and boxes of documents from Paula Broadwell's house in North Carolina. And she's, of course, the woman who had the affair with David Petraeus that led to his resignation. And the FBI is looking at whether she was improperly given classified information.
And whether that was given by General Petraeus, but we have no idea.
Or someone else, correct, yeah. They're just investigating that at this point.
And the link here, for those who haven't maybe been reading the newspaper articles, the Jill Kelly, the Tampa socialite, originally complained about harassing emails sent to her, which turned out to be from Paula Broadwell, which is how the Petraeus affair came to light.
And to complicate this,
did I get
even,
that?
To complicate this even further, Paula Broadwell, under another name, sent an email to General Allen saying, watch out for this woman, Jill Kelly. She's a seductress and so forth. General Allen looks at this and basically says, this is odd, and sends it to Jill Kelly. And she got other emails apparently along these lines, maybe from General Allen or others. She in turn goes to the FBI, and that's what started this whole case. So it comes full circle back to General Allen.
So it's not just an episode on reality TV. It's like a mini-series.
Right. You almost need a chart to figure this whole thing out.
And just, you know, Tom, you cover the military. I mean, people might be going, huh, what is a socialite in Tampa doing having such, you know, ongoing relationship and emails and friendship with all these generals?
Well, she's a big part of the community down there. Her husband is a physician. They're wealthy. They have a big mansion. So they would have, you know, they would host galas for the Red Cross down there. Visiting delegations from Afghanistan would go to parties at the house. They sort of adopted MacDill Air Force Base, the local, base where General Petraeus was stationed, and also General Allen as well. So they were movers and shakers in the Tampa community,
and
they were linked to the military.
And we should say that family members and friends of each side of General Allen and Jill Kelly have denied there was any improper relationship.
They've denied that, yes. General Allen has denied any improper relationship, and also Jill Kelly and General Allen's wife are close friends.
All right. Ron Elving, Mr. Obama didn't plan on being asked about this at his first post-election press conference. The question will come up, should he and the other administration officials have known this was happening sooner? Apparently it all started 6 months ago.
Yes, this has been going on for some period of time, and I think the average person, the average man on the street, woman on the street, would say if the FBI is investigating somebody such as the CIA director, and if the FBI ultimately answers to the Secretary to the Attorney General, the head of the Department of Justice, and if that person eventually answers to the president, mightn't there have been some communication among these people somewhere along the line? Hey, you know what's going on? They're actually investigating. Some of our people are investigating. David Petraeus over at CIA.
And of course, the fact that it came out the day after the election obviously looks suspicious.
That's right. And of course, Jay Carney, the spokesperson for the president, has been telling the folks at the White House that the president learned nothing until Thursday, and when he was quite surprised when he had heard of it. All right, that's the official line. And also, officially, if you go back over our history and you look at not only the National Security Act in the Ronald Reagan era, but also all the way back to Watergate, there's been a lot of back and forth about what the FBI and the CIA should know about each other and about what each and the other might be investigating, particularly if it gets into one agency investigating the other, and also about how much of that should be shared with the White House, lest the entire thing be politicized, because going all the way back, and it's just 40 years ago exactly this fall, that the FBI and the CIA and a lot of other people in Washington, D.C. were at war over the Watergate break-in, and whether or not the White House wanted that to actually be investigated and brought to light, which eventually was, but only because journalists got involved and forced it all out into the open, using, of course, a very highly placed person at the FBI as their main source. That was Deep Throat, Mark Felt, as we now know.
There's arguments on both sides whether or not this should have come out earlier or not.
And people are going to have very strong opinions on both sides as to whether or not it was known at the White House and just now came out, or whether or not the White House was involved in some kind of a cover-up, or whether, in fact, they were kept in the dark like the rest of us.
Scott Horsley. I'm going to have to spice up your beat now, you know, to compete. The fiscal cliff.
Whoa, come on, the fiscal cliff.
Scintillating fiscal cliff is what we have been expecting to focus on this week. President Obama has been meeting with various interest groups. What is happening as in the run-up to these budget talks?
That's right. The president met yesterday with leaders of various labor unions and progressive organizations. He's going to meet later today after his news conference with a number of business CEOs, and he's basically trying to rope in both the left and the right on his behalf as he prepares to meet on Friday with the Democratic and Republican congressional leadership and basically try to negotiate a detour that will steer clear of the fiscal cliff, that is the automatic spending cuts and the tax hikes that are set to take effect on January 1 if Congress doesn't do something first to stop them.
And what have we heard various groups say in terms of what they hope will come out of these talks?
Well, the labor unions who met with the president yesterday were encouraged that he is holding a hard line, that any agreement, any kind of compromise has to include more tax revenue from upper-income Americans. At the same time, the president did not rule out giving some ground on entitlement, which is something that the Republicans are anxious to see and which labor unions in general don't want to see, or at least they don't want to see a whole lot of movement in the way of entitlement programs. I think the business community, the CEOs who are meeting with the president this afternoon, I think are mostly just interested in seeing a deal done. They would be open to more revenues, more tax revenues coming in from wealthy Americans, although since they're mostly in that group, they might not be eager to be writing larger checks to the IRS. But I think they're willing to do that if that's what it takes to avoid the uncertainty of actually seeing all the tax rates go up on January 1st.
And there's been such posturing since the elections. Where do things stand in terms of, Republicans and Democrats feeling emboldened or maybe like they're going to have to give?
Well, a lot of reporters in Washington are just so used to seeing anything that the president is for being anathema to Republicans and vice versa that they just automatically assume that they're going to be at loggerheads. But if you sort of read between the lines, you can actually see that there has been there have been doors left open. John Boehner has said he's open to additional tax revenues coming in from wealthy Americans, albeit not an increase in marginal tax rates. The president has mostly talked about raising tax revenues from the wealthy. He's not drawn a line in the sand yet. I'm sure he'll be asked about this during the news conference, if he's insistent that tax rates go back up to where they were in the Clinton era. But so there certainly is some room for compromise. Now, yesterday, Jay Carney, the president's spokesman, made it clear that the president's sort of opening gambit is to raise $1.6 trillion in additional revenue over the next decade. That's about double the figure that he and John Boehner came close to reaching a deal on in the summer of 2011. So, that's a pretty high bar. On the other hand, that is his opening gambit. So perhaps it's, like when you're price your house high and try to leave yourself some room to bargain down.
We also heard Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner say, look, don't think you can only do this by capping deductions. You're going to have some tax rates rise.
Well, that's right. Secretary Geithner said that yesterday, although actually, you know, we have about $1 trillion a year in these so-called tax expenditures. So if you made a meaningful whack at trying to close some of those, you know, one man's loophole is another man's precious tax deduction. But if you really went after those tax expenditures, there is an awful lot of revenue that you could gain there. One idea that Republicans have been banding about is to say cap what folks can list on their Schedule A of their tax form at $50,000. Just by doing that gets you to $749 billion over a decade. So you're almost to that $800 billion mark just by capping deductions at $50,000. And if you do that, most of the pain is on the upper income. 96% of that would come out of the hides of the top 20% of earners. Almost 80% of it would come out of the top 1% of earners. And if you were to set the cap a little bit lower, say around $25,000, now you're up to, you know, close to $1.3 trillion in revenue. So there is a lot of revenue to be raised out there. Now, the president, of course, wants his $1.6 trillion figure talks about doing both those things, both raising the marginal rate on high earners back to where they were in the 90s and closing loopholes. The Republicans are sort of talking about it as an either or.
Huh. Ron Elving, you're nodding your head, so there could be room to maneuver here.
What Scott has just described with such clarity is the shape of a deal. It is truly the shape of a deal. Now, of course, there has to be something coming from the other side in terms of meaningful entitlement reform, as the Republicans call it, or restraining the growth of the cost of Medicare and Social Security.
Which we did hear that President Obama apparently, right, was willing to do less the summer of 2011?
Reportedly. We don't know that for sure. But there is a group, the Center for American Progress, that is proposing doing some very serious things on the side of spending restraint in Medicare and Social Security. That group is associated with the White House. It isn't the White House, but that is a little sign of ankle on the other side as well. So we may be seeing the outlines of a deal.
Hmm. Tom Bowman, back to you. General John Allen, who will come up at this press conference, I'm sure. He was scheduled to have a confirmation hearing this week. He was nominated to be the Supreme Allied Commander in NATO. That's where does that stand?
Yeah, his hearing has been canceled, and also his nomination has been put on hold. And as far as Petraeus is concerned, he will testify Friday before the Senate Intelligence Committee about Benghazi and the questions about lack of security at the consulate. So that's going on now. And there's a State Department investigation into whether there was enough security at the compound. And of course, that's where the U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed.
And we had Senator John McCain today call for a Watergate-style commission into those killings.
That's right. McCain says you really need a separate special committee that looks at across the board of the government, that would look at the military, CIA, and other agencies here. A lot of complex questions involved here. And the key question is, if people in the State Department on the ground were calling for more security, why wasn't that security given to them at that consulate? You don't lose an American ambassador. That's not supposed to happen. Clearly, we all know at this point there wasn't enough security. Big question is why.
Hmm. We're waiting for President Obama to speak any moment now in his first post-election press conference. Ron Elving.
Ladies and gentlemen,
and here we are.
President of the United States.
Good afternoon, everybody. Please have a seat. I hear you have some questions for me. But let me just make a few remarks at the top, and then I'll open it up. First of all, I want to reiterate what I said on Friday. Right now, our economy is still recovering from a very deep and damaging crisis. So our top priority has to be jobs and growth. We've got to build on the progress that we've made, because this nation succeeds when we've got a growing, thriving middle class. And that's the idea at the core of the plan that I talked about on the campaign trail over the last year, rewarding manufacturers and small businesses that create jobs here, not overseas, providing more Americans the chance to earn the skills that businesses are looking for right now, keeping this country at the forefront of research, technology, and clean energy, putting people back to work, rebuilding our roads, our bridges, and our schools, and reducing our deficit in a balanced and responsible way. Now, on this last item, we face a very clear deadline that requires us to make some big decisions on jobs, taxes, and deficits by the end of the year. Both parties voted to set this deadline, and I believe that both parties can work together to make these decisions in a balanced and responsible way. Yesterday, I had a chance to meet with labor and civic leaders for their input. Today, I'm meeting with CEOs of some of America's largest companies, and I'll meet with leaders of both parties of Congress before the week is out, because there's only one way to solve these challenges, and that is to do it together. As I've said before, I'm open to compromise and I'm open to new ideas. And I've been encouraged over the past week to hear Republican after Republican agree on the need for more revenue from the wealthiest Americans as part of our arithmetic if we're going to be serious about reducing the deficit. Because when it comes to taxes, there are two pathways available. Option one, if Congress fails to act by the end of this year, everybody's taxes will automatically go up, including the 98% of Americans who make less than $250,000 a year, and the 97% of small businesses who earn less than $250,000 a year. That doesn't make sense. Our economy can't afford that right now. Certainly no middle-class family can afford that right now. And nobody in either party says that they want it to happen. The other option is to pass a law right now that would prevent any tax hike whatsoever on the first $250,000 of everybody's income. And by the way, that means every American, including the wealthiest Americans, get a tax cut. It means that 98% of all Americans and 97% of all small businesses won't see their taxes go up a single dime. The Senate has already passed a law like this. Democrats in the House are ready to pass a law like this. And I hope Republicans in the House come on board, too. We should not hold the middle class hostage while we debate tax cuts for the wealthy. We should at least do what we agree on, and that's to keep middle class taxes low. And I'll bring everyone in to sign it right away so we can give folks some certainty before the holiday season. I won't pretend that figuring out everything else will be easy, but I'm confident we can do it, and I know we have to. I know that that's what the American people want us to do. That was the very clear message from the election last week, and that was the message of a letter that I received over the weekend. It came from a man in Tennessee who began by writing that he didn't vote for me, which is okay. But what he said was, even though he didn't give me his vote, he's giving me his support to move this country forward. And he said the same to his Republican representatives in Washington. He said that he'll back each of us, regardless of party, as long as we work together to make life better for all of us. And he made it clear that if we don't make enough progress, he'll be back in touch. So my hope, he wrote, is that we can make progress in light of personal and party principles, special interest groups, and years of business as usual. We've got to work together and put our differences aside. I couldn't say it better myself. That's precisely what I intend to do. And with that, let me open it up for your questions. And I'm going to start off with Ben Feller of AP.
Thank you, Mr. President. Can you assure the American people that there have been no breaches of national security or classified information in the scandal involving Generals Petraeus and Allen? And do you think that you, as Commander-in-Chief, and the American people should have been told that the CIA chief was under investigation before the election?
Well, I have no evidence at this point, from what I've seen, that classified information was disclosed that in any way would have had a negative impact on our national security. Obviously, there's an ongoing investigation. I don't want to comment on the specifics of the investigation. The FBI has its own protocols in terms of how they proceed. I'm going to let Director Mueller and others examine those protocols and make some statements to the public generally. I do want to emphasize what I've said before. General Petraeus had an extraordinary career. He served this country with great distinction in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and as head of the CIA. By his own assessment, he did not meet the standards that he felt were necessary as the director of CIA with respect to this personal matter that he is now dealing with his family and with his wife. And it's on that basis that he tendered his resignation, and it's on that basis that I accepted it. But I want to emphasize that, from my perspective at least, he has provided this country an extraordinary service. We are safer because of the work that Dave Petraeus has done. And my main hope right now is that he and his family are able to move on and that this ends up being a single side note on what has otherwise been an extraordinary career.
What about voters? Do they deserve
to know? Again, I think you're going to have to talk to the FBI in terms of what their general protocols are when it comes to what started off as a potential criminal investigation. One of the challenges here is that we're not supposed to meddle in criminal investigations, and that's been our practice. And I think that there are certain procedures that both the FBI follow or DOJ follow when they're involved in these investigations. That's traditionally been how we view things, in part because people are innocent until proven guilty, and we want to make sure that we don't prejudge these kinds of situations. And so my expectation is that they follow protocols that they already established. Good. Jessica Yellen. Where's Jessica? Right there.
Mr. President, on the fiscal cliff, 2 years ago, sir, you said that you wouldn't extend the Bush-era tax cuts, but at the end of the day, you did. So respectfully, sir, why should the American people and the Republicans believe that you won't cave again this time?
Well, 2 years ago, the economy was in a different situation. We were still very much in the early parts of recovering from the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And ultimately, we came together not only to extend the Bush tax cuts, but also a wide range of policies that were going to be good for the economy at that point. Unemployment insurance extensions, payroll tax extension, all of which made a difference and is part of the reason why what we've seen now is 32 consecutive months of job growth and over 5.5 million jobs created and the unemployment rate coming down. But what I said at the time is what I meant, which is this was a one-time proposition. And what I have told leaders privately as well as publicly is that we cannot afford to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. What we can do is make sure that middle-class taxes don't go up. And so the most important step we can take right now, and I think the foundation for a deal that helps the economy, creates jobs, gives consumers certainty, which means gives businesses confidence that they're going to have consumers during the holiday season, is if we right away say 98% of Americans are not going to see their taxes go up. 97% of small businesses are not going to see their taxes go up. If we get that in place, we are actually removing half of the fiscal cliff. Half of the danger to our economy is removed by that single step. And what we can then do is shape a process whereby we look at tax reform, which I'm very eager to do. I think we can simplify our tax system. I think we can make it more efficient. We can eliminate loopholes and deductions that have a distorting effect on our economy. I believe that we have to continue to take a serious look at how we reform our entitlements because health care costs continue to be the biggest driver of our deficits. So there is a package to be shaped, and I'm confident that parties folks of goodwill in both parties can make that happen. But what I'm not going to do is to extend Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest 2% that we can't afford, and according to economists, will have the least positive impact on our economy.
You've said that the wealthiest must pay more. Would closing loopholes instead of raising rates for them satisfy you?
I think that there are loopholes that can be closed, and we should look at how we can make the process of deductions, the filing process, easier, simpler. But when it comes to the top 2%, what I'm not going to do is to extend further a tax cut for folks who don't need it, which would cost close to $1 trillion. And it's very difficult to see how you make up that $1 trillion, if we're serious about deficit reduction, just by closing loopholes and deductions. The math tends not to work. And I think it's important to establish a basic principle that was debated extensively during the course of this campaign. I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. This was, if there was one thing that everybody understood was a big difference between myself and Mr. Romney, it was when it comes to how we reduce our deficit, I argued for a balanced, responsible approach, and part of that included making sure that the wealthiest Americans pay a little bit more. I think every voter out there understood that that was an important debate, and the majority of voters agreed with me. Not, by the way, more voters agreed with me on this issue than voted for me. So we've got a clear majority of the American people who recognize if we're going to be serious about deficit reduction, we've got to do it in a balanced way. The only question now is, are we going to hold the middle class hostage in order to go ahead and let that happen? Or can we all step back and say, here's something we agree on. We don't want middle class taxes to go up. Let's go ahead and lock that in. That will be good for the economy. It will be good for consumers. It will be good for businesses. It takes the edge off the fiscal cliff. And let's also then commit ourselves to the broader package of deficit reduction that includes entitlement changes, and it includes potentially tax reform, as well as I'm willing to look at additional work that we can do on the discretionary spending side. So I want a big deal. I want a comprehensive deal. I want to see if we can, at least for the foreseeable future, provide certainty to businesses and the American people so that we can focus on job growth, so that we're also investing in the things that we need. But right now, what I want to make sure of is that taxes on middle-class families don't go up. And there's a very easy way to do that. We could get that done by next week. Okay. Lori Montenegro, Telemundo.
Where's that? Thank you, Mr. President. On immigration reform, the criticism in the past has been that you did not put forth legislation with specific ideas and send it up to the Hill. This time around, you have said again that this will be one of the top priorities for a second term. Will you then send legislation to the Hill? And exactly what do you envision is broad immigration reform? Does that include a legalization program? And also, what lessons, if any, did Democrats learn from this last election and the Latino vote?
Well, I think what was incredibly encouraging was to see a significant increase in Latino turnout. It is the fastest growing group in the country. And, historically, what you've seen is Latino vote at lower rates than the broader population. And that's beginning to change. You're starting to see a sense of empowerment and civic participation that I think is going to be powerful and good for the country. And it is why I'm very confident that we can get immigration reform done. Before the election, I had given a couple of interviews where I predicted that Latino vote was going to be strong and that that would cause some reflection on the part of Republicans about their position on immigration reform. I think we're starting to see that already. I think that's a positive sign. This has not historically been a partisan issue. We've had President Bush and John McCain and others who have supported comprehensive immigration reform in the past. So we need to seize the moment. And my expectation is that we get a bill introduced and we begin the process in Congress very soon after my inauguration. And in fact, some conversations I think are already beginning to take place among senators and congressmen and my staff about what would this look like. And when I say comprehensive immigration reform, it is very similar to the outlines of previous efforts at comprehensive immigration reform. I think it should include a continuation of the strong border security measures that we've taken, because we have to secure our borders. I think it should contain serious penalties for companies that are purposely hiring undocumented workers and taking advantage of them. And I do think that there should be a pathway for legal status for those who are living in this country, are not engaged in criminal activity, are here simply to work. It's important for them to pay back taxes. It's important for them to learn English. It's important for them to potentially pay a fine. But to give them the avenue whereby they can resolve their legal status here in this country, I think, is very important. Obviously, making sure that we put into law what the first step that we've taken administratively dealing with the DREAM Act kids is very important as well. One thing that I'm very clear about is that young people who are brought here through no fault of their own, who have gone to school here, pledged allegiance to our flag, want to serve in our military, want to go to school and contribute to our society, that they shouldn't be under the cloud of deportation, that we should give them every opportunity to earn their citizenship. And so, you know, there are other components to it, obviously. The business community continues to be concerned about getting enough high-skill workers, and I am a believer that if you've got a PhD in physics or computer science who wants to stay here and start a business here, we shouldn't make it harder for him to stay here. We should try to encourage him to contribute to this society. I think that the agricultural sector obviously has very specific concerns about making sure that they've got a workforce that helps deliver food to our table. So there are going to be a bunch of components to it, but I think whatever process we have needs to make sure border security is strong, needs to deal with employers effectively, needs to provide a pathway for the undocumented here, needs to deal with the DREAM Act kids, and I think that's something that we can get done. Chuck Todd. Where's Chuck?
Mr. President, I just want to follow up on a couple, both Ben's question and Jessica's question. On having to do with Ben's question, are you
How about Lori's question? Do you want to follow up on that one, too?
I feel like you answered that one completely. Are you withholding judgment on whether you should have known sooner that there was a potential that there was an investigation into whether your CIA director, potentially there was a national security breach with your CIA director? Do you believe you should have known sooner, or are you withholding judgment until the investigation is complete on that front? And then the follow-up to Jessica's question, tax rates. Is there no deal at the end of the year if tax rates for the top 2% aren't the Clinton tax rates, period? No ifs, ands, or buts and any room in negotiating on that specific aspect of the fiscal cliff?
I am withholding judgment with respect to how the entire process surrounding General Petraeus came up. We don't have all the information yet, but I want to say that I have a lot of confidence generally in the FBI, and they've got a difficult job. So I'm going to wait and see to see if there's any other. Well, I mean, Chuck, what I'll say is that if it is also possible that had we been told, then you'd be sitting here asking a question about why were you interfering in a criminal investigation. So I think it's best right now for us to just see how this whole process unfolded. With respect to the tax rates, I just want to emphasize, I am open to new ideas if the Republican counterparts or some Democrats have a great idea for us to raise revenue, maintain progressivity, make sure the middle class isn't getting hit reduces our deficit, encourages growth. I'm not going to just slam the door in their face. I want to hear idea. I want to hear ideas from everybody. Well, look, I believe this is solvable. I think that fair-minded people can come to an agreement that does not cause the economy to go back into recession, that protects middle-class families, that focuses on jobs and growth, and reduces our deficit. I'm confident it can be done. My budget, frankly, does it. I understand that I don't expect the Republicans simply to adopt my budget. That's not realistic. So I recognize that we're going to have to compromise. And as I said on election night, compromise is hard. And not everybody gets 100% of what they want, and not everybody is going to be perfectly happy. But what I will not do is to have a process that is vague, that says we're going to sort of kind of raise revenue through dynamic scoring or closing loopholes that have not been identified. And the reason I won't do that is because I don't want to find ourselves in a position 6 months from now or a year from now where, lo and behold, the only way to close a deficit is to sock it to middle-class families or to burden families that have disabled kids or, you know, have a parent in a nursing home. Or suddenly we've got to cut more out of our basic research budget that is the key to growing the economy in the long term. So that's my concern. I'm less concerned about red lines per se. What I'm concerned about is not finding ourselves in a situation where the wealthy aren't paying more or aren't paying as much as they should. Middle-class families, one way or another, are making up the difference. That's the kind of status quo that has been going on here too long, and that's exactly what I argued against during this campaign. And if there's one thing that I'm pretty confident about is the American people understood what they were getting when they gave me this incredible privilege of being in office for another 4 years. They want compromise. They want action. But they also want to make sure that middle-class folks aren't bearing the entire burden and sacrifice when it comes to some of these big challenges. They expect that folks at the top are doing their fair share as well, and that's going to be my guiding principle during these negotiations, but more importantly, during the next 4 years of my administration. Nancy Cordes.
Mr. President, on election night, you said that you were looking forward to speaking with Governor Romney, sitting down in the coming weeks to discuss ways that you could work together on this nation's problems. Have you extended that invitation? Has he accepted? And in what ways do you think you can work together?
You know, we haven't scheduled something yet. I think everybody forgets that the election was only a week ago, and I know I've forgotten. I forgot on Wednesday. I think everybody needs to catch their breath. I'm sure that Governor Romney is spending some time with his family. My hope is before the end of the year, though, that we have a chance to sit down and talk. There are certain aspects of Governor Romney's record and his ideas that I think could be very helpful. To give you one example, I do think he did a terrific job running the Olympics. And, you know, that skill set of trying to figure out how do we make something work better applies to the federal government. There are a lot of ideas that I don't think are partisan ideas, but are just smart ideas about how can we make the federal government more customer-friendly, how can we make sure that, we're consolidating programs that are duplicative. How can we eliminate additional waste? He presented some ideas during the course of the campaign that I actually agree with. So it'd be interesting to talk to him about something like that. There may be ideas that he has with respect to jobs and growth that can help middle-class families that I want to hear. So, I'm not either prejudging what he's interested in doing, nor am I is suggesting I've got some specific assignment. But what I want to do is to get ideas from him and see if there's some ways that we can potentially work together.
You're listening
Congress,
to special coverage
one of, the most
of a press conference with President Barack Obama in the White House.
The past few years from members on both sides is that you haven't done enough to reach out and build relationships. Are there concrete ways that you plan to approach your relationships with Congress in a second term?
Look, I think there's no doubt that I can always do better. And so I will examine ways that I can make sure to communicate my desire to work with everybody, so long as it's advancing the cause of strengthening our middle class and improving our economy. I've got a lot of good relationships with folks both in the House and the Senate. I have a lot of relationships on both sides of the aisle. It hasn't always manifested itself in the kind of agreements that I'd like to see between Democrats and Republicans, and so I think all of us have responsibilities to see if there are things that we can improve on. And I don't exempt myself from needing to do some self-reflection and see if I can improve our working relationship. There are probably going to be still some very sharp differences. And as I said during the campaign, there are going to be times where there are fights, and I think those are fights that need to be had. But what I think the American people don't want to see is a focus on the next election instead of a focus on them. And I don't have another election. And, Michelle and I were talking last night about, what an incredible honor and privilege it is to be put in this position. And there are people all across this country, millions of folks, who worked so hard to help us get elected, but they're also millions of people who may not have voted for us but are also counting on us. And we take that responsibility very seriously. I take that responsibility very seriously. And I hope and intend to be an even better president in the second term than I was in the first. Jonathan Carl.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham both said today that they want to have Watergate-style hearings on the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, and said that if you nominate Susan Rice to be Secretary of State, they will do everything in their power to block her nomination. As Senator Graham said, he simply doesn't trust Ambassador Rice after what she said about Benghazi. I'd like your reaction to that, and would those threats deter you from making a nomination like that?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to comment at this point on various nominations that I'll put forward to fill out my cabinet for the second term. Those are things that are still being discussed. But let me say specifically about Susan Rice. She has done exemplary work. She has represented the United States and our interests in the United Nations with skill and professionalism and toughness and grace. As I've said before, she made an appearance at the request of the White House in which she gave her best understanding of the intelligence that had been provided to her. If Senator McCain and Senator Graham and others want to go after somebody, they should go after me. And I'm happy to have that discussion with them. But for them to go after the UN ambassador, who had nothing to do with Benghazi, and was simply making a presentation based on intelligence that she had received, and to besmirch her reputation, is outrageous. And, we're after an election now. I think it is important for us to find out exactly what happened in Benghazi, and I'm happy to cooperate in any ways that Congress wants. We have provided every bit of information that we have, and we will continue to provide information, and we've got a full-blown investigation. And all that information will be disgorged to Congress. And I don't think there's any debate in this country that when you have four Americans killed, that's a problem. And we've got to get to the bottom of it, and there needs to be accountability. We've got to bring those who carried it out to justice. They won't get any debate from me on that. But when they go after the UN ambassador, apparently because they think she's an easy target, then they've got a problem with me. And should I choose, if I think that she would be the best person to serve America in the capacity of the State Department, then I will nominate her. That's not a determination that I've made yet. Okay. Ed Henry.
I want to take Chuck's lead and just ask a very small follow-up, which is whether you feel you have a mandate, not just on taxes, but on a range of issues because of your decisive victory. But I want to stay in Benghazi based on what John asked, because you said if they want to come after me, come after me. I wanted to ask about the families of these four Americans who were killed. Sean Smith's father, Ray, said he believes his son basically called 911 for help, and they didn't get it. And I know you've said you grieve for these four Americans, that it's being investigated, but the families have been waiting for more than 2 months. So I would like to, for you to address the families if you can. On 9/11, as Commander-in-Chief, did you issue any orders to try to protect their lives?
I'll address the families not through the press. I'll address the families directly, as I already have. And we will provide all the information that is available about what happened on that day. That's what the investigation's for. But as I said repeatedly, if people don't think that we did everything we can to make sure that we saved the lives of folks who I sent there and who were carrying out missions on behalf of the United States, then you don't know how our Defense Department thinks or our State Department thinks or our CIA thinks. Their number one priority is obviously to protect American lives. That's what our job is. Now, Ed, I will put forward every bit of information that we have. I can tell you that immediately upon finding out that our folks were in danger, that my orders to my national security team were do whatever we need to do to make sure they're safe. And that's the same order that I would give any time that I see Americans are in danger, whether they're civilian or military, because that's our number one priority. Okay. With respect to the issue of mandate, I've got one mandate. I've got a mandate to help middle-class families and families that are working hard to try to get in the middle class. That's my mandate. That's what the American people said. They said, work really hard to help us. Don't worry about the politics of it. Don't worry about the party interests. Don't worry about the special interests. Just work really hard to see if you can help us get ahead, because we're working really hard out here and we're still struggling, a lot of us. That's my mandate. I don't presume that because I won an election that everybody suddenly agrees with me on everything. I'm more than familiar with all the literature about presidential overreach in second terms. We are very cautious about that. On the other hand, I didn't get reelected just to bask in reelection. I got elected to do work on behalf of American families and small businesses all across the country who are still recovering from a really bad recession, but are hopeful about the future. And I am, too. The one thing that I said during the campaign that maybe sounds like a bunch of campaign rhetoric, but now that the campaign's over, I'm going to repeat it, and hopefully you guys will really believe me. When you travel around the country, you are inspired by the grit and resilience and hard work and decency of the American people. And it just makes you want to work harder. You know, you meet families who are have overcome really tough odds and somehow are making it and sending their kids to college. And you meet young people who are doing incredible work in disadvantaged communities because they believe in the American ideal, and it should be available for everybody. And yeah, you meet farmers who are helping each other's during times of drought, and you know, you meet businesses that kept their doors open during the recession, even though the owner didn't have to take a salary. And you, when you talk to these folks, you say to yourself, man, they deserve a better government than they've been getting. They deserve, all of us here in Washington, to be thinking every single day, how can I make things a little better for them? Which isn't to say that everything we do is going to be perfect, or that there aren't just going to be some big, tough challenges that we have to grapple with. But I do know that federal government can make a difference. We're seeing it right now on the Jersey coast and in New York. People are still going through a really tough time. The response hasn't been perfect, but it's been aggressive and strong and fast and robust, and a lot of people have been helped because of it. And that's a pretty good metaphor for how I want the federal government to operate generally, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it does. Christy Parson. Hey.
Thank you, Mr. President, and congratulations, by the
Thanks.
Way. One quick follow-up.
Christy was there when I was running for state senate.
That's so right, I was.
Christy and I go back a ways.
I've never seen you lose. I wasn't looking that one time.
There you go.
One quick follow-up, and then I want to ask you about Iran. I just want to make sure I understood what you said. Can you envision any scenario in which we do go off the fiscal cliff at the end of the year? And on Iran, are you preparing a final diplomatic push here to resolve the nuclear program issue? And are we headed toward one-on-one talks?
Well, obviously, we can all imagine a scenario where we go off the fiscal cliff. If despite the election, if despite the dangers of going over the fiscal cliff and what that means for our economy, that there's too much stubbornness in Congress that we can't even agree on giving middle-class families a tax cut, then middle-class families are all going to end up having a big tax hike. And that's going to be a pretty rude shock for them, and I suspect will have a big impact on the holiday shopping season, which in turn will have an impact on business planning and hiring, and we can go back into a recession. It would be a bad thing. It is not necessary. So I want to repeat, step number one that we can take in the next couple of weeks, provide certainty to middle-class families. 98% of families who make less than $250,000 a year, 97% of small businesses, that their taxes will not go up a single dime next year. Give them that certainty right now. We can get that done. We can then set up a structure whereby we are dealing with tax reform, closing deductions, closing loopholes, simplifying, dealing with entitlements, and I'm ready and willing to make big commitments to make sure that we're locking in the kind of deficit reductions that stabilize our deficit, start bringing it down, start bringing down our debt. I'm confident we can do it. And look, I've been living with this for a couple of years now. I know the math pretty well, and it really is arithmetic. It's not calculus. There are some tough things that have to be done, but there's a way of doing this that does not hurt middle-class families, that does not hurt our seniors, doesn't hurt families with disabled kids, allows us to continue to invest in those things that make us grow, like basic research and education, helping young people afford going to college. As we've already heard from some Republican commentators, a modest tax increase on the wealthy is not going to break their backs. They'll still be wealthy, and it will not impinge on business investment. So we know how to do this. This is just a matter of whether or not we come together and go ahead and say, Democrats and Republicans, we're both going to hold hands and do what's right for the American people. And I hope that's what happens. With respect to Iran, I very much want to see a diplomatic resolution to
the problem. I was very clear before the campaign, I was clear during the campaign, and I'm now clear after the campaign. We're not going to let Iran get a nuclear weapon. But I think there is still a window of time for us to resolve this diplomatically. We've imposed the toughest sanctions in history. It is having an impact on Iran's economy. There should be a way in which they can enjoy peaceful nuclear power while still meeting their international obligations and providing clear assurances to the international community that they're not pursuing a nuclear weapon. And so, yes, I will try to make a push in the coming months to see if we can open up a dialogue between Iran and not just us, but the international community, to see if we can get this thing resolved. I can't promise that Iran will walk through the door that they need to walk through, but that would be very much the preferable option.
And under what circumstances would one-on-one conversation
take place? I won't talk about the details of negotiations, but I think it's fair to say that we want to get this resolved, and we're not going to be constrained by diplomatic niceties or protocols. If Iran is serious about wanting to resolve this, they'll be in a position to resolve it.
At one point, just prior to the election, there was talk that talks might be imminent.
That was not true, and it's not true as of today. Okay.
You're listening to special coverage of a press conference with President Barack Obama. This is NPR News.
There it is, right in front of him.
Thank you, Mr. President. In his endorsement of you a few weeks ago, Mayor Bloomberg said he was motivated by the belief that you would do more to confront the threat of climate change than your opponent. Tomorrow you're going up to New York City, where you're going to, I assume, see people who are still suffering the effects of Hurricane Sandy, which many people say is further evidence of how a warming globe is changing our weather. What specifically do you plan to do in a second term to tackle the issue of climate change? And do you think the political will exists in Washington to pass legislation that could include some kind of a tax on carbon?
You know, as you know, Mark, we can't attribute any particular weather event to climate change. What we do know is the temperature around the globe is increasing faster than was predicted even 10 years ago. We do know that the Arctic ice cap is melting faster than was predicted even 5 years ago. We do know that there have been extraordinarily there have been an extraordinarily large number of severe weather events here in North America, but also around the globe. And I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior and carbon emissions. And as a consequence, I think we've got an obligation to future generations to do something about it. Now, in my first term, we doubled fuel efficiency standards on cars and trucks. That will have an impact. That will take a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. We doubled the production of clean energy, which promises to reduce the utilization of fossil fuels for power generation. And we continue to invest in potential breakthrough technologies that could further remove carbon from our atmosphere. But we haven't done as much as we need to. So what I'm going to be doing over the next several weeks, next several months, is having a conversation, a wide-ranging conversation with scientists, engineers, and elected officials to find out what more can we do to make short-term progress in reducing carbons. And then, you know, working through an education process that I think is necessary, a discussion, a conversation across the country about, you know, what realistically can we do long-term to make sure that this is not something we're passing on to future generations that's going to be very expensive and very painful to deal with. I don't know what either Democrats or Republicans are prepared to do at this point because you know, this is one of those issues that's not just a partisan issue. I also think there are regional differences. There's no doubt that for us to take on climate change in a serious way would involve making some tough political choices. And, you know, understandably, I think the American people right now have been so focused and will continue to be focused on our economy and jobs and growth that, you know, if the message is somehow we're going to ignore jobs and growth simply to address climate change, I don't think anybody's going to go for that. I won't go for that. If, on the other hand, we can shape an agenda that says we can create jobs, advance growth, and make a serious dent in climate change and be an international leader, I think that's something that the American people would support. So, you know, you can expect that you'll hear more from me in the coming months and years about how we can shape an agenda that garners bipartisan support and helps move this moves this agenda forward.
It sounds like you're saying that in the current environment, we're probably still short of a consensus on some kind of attack.
That I'm pretty certain of. And look, we're still trying to debate whether we can just make sure that middle class families don't get a tax hike. Let's see if we can resolve that. That should be easy. This one's hard, but it's important because, you know, one of the things that we don't always factor in are the costs involved in these natural disasters. We just put them off as something that's unconnected to our behavior right now. And I think what, based on the evidence we're seeing, is that what we do now is going to have an impact and a cost down the road if we don't do something about it. All right, last question. Mark Felsenthal. Where's Mark?
Thank you. Mr. President, the Assad regime is engaged in a brutal crackdown on its people. France has recognized the opposition coalition. What would it take for the United States to do the same? And is there any point at which the United States would consider arming the rebels?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was one of the first leaders, I think, around the world to say Assad had to go in response to the incredible brutality that his government displayed in the face of what were initially peaceful protests. Obviously, the situation in Syria has deteriorated since then. We have been extensively engaged with the international community as well as regional powers to help the opposition. You know, we've committed to hundreds of millions of dollars of humanitarian aid to help folks both inside of Syria and outside of Syria. We are constantly consulting with the opposition on how they can get organized so that they're not splintered and divided in the face of the onslaught from the Assad regime. We are in very close contact with countries like Turkey and Jordan that immediately border Syria and have an impact, and obviously Israel, which is having already grave concerns, as we do, about, for example, movements of chemical weapons that might occur in such a chaotic atmosphere. And that could have an impact not just within Syria, but on the region as a whole. I'm encouraged to see that the Syrian opposition created an umbrella group that may have more cohesion than they have had in the past. We're going to be talking to them. My envoys are going to be traveling to you know, various meetings that are going to be taking place with the international community and the opposition. We consider them a legitimate representative of the aspirations of the Syrian people. We're not yet prepared to recognize them as some sort of government in exile, but we do think that it is a broad-based representative group. One of the questions that we're going to continue to press is making sure that that opposition is committed to a democratic Syria, an inclusive Syria, a moderate Syria. We have seen extremist elements insinuate themselves into the opposition, and you know, one of the things that we have to be on guard about, particularly when we start talking about arming opposition figures, is that we're not indirectly putting arms in the hands of folks who would do Americans harm or do Israelis harm or otherwise engage in actions that are detrimental to our national security. So we're constantly probing and working on that issue. The more engaged we are, the more we'll be in a position to make sure that that we are encouraging the most moderate, thoughtful elements of the opposition that are committed to inclusion, observance of human rights, and working cooperatively with us over the long term. All right? Thank you very much.
Is that something that you could see having a short-term postponement for? Because during the debate you said it's not going to happen.
That was a great question, but it would be a horrible precedent for me to answer your question just because you yelled it out. So thank you very much, guys.
And from NPR News, you've been listening to special coverage of President Barack Obama's first press conference since his reelection last week. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Mr. Obama talked about wanting a balanced and responsible budget deal and said we should not hold the middle class hostage while we debate tax cuts for the wealthy. We're joined now with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, our White House correspondent Scott Horsley, and Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Ron Elving, what did you a lot of talk on the budget and trying to get the president to draw red lines, which he didn't quite do.
The president did not tip his hand with respect to negotiation on the budget nearly as much as I think some people would have liked to have heard him do. I don't think that he gave up much with respect to the revenue question. He said that he was not willing to say that tax rates absolutely had to go back to the Clinton-era numbers from the 1990s before he would be satisfied. He made it clear that's what he was proposing, but that it could get there some other way. There could be some other form of balance that would get them there. That was probably the closest thing to the rubber really meeting the road on the whole fiscal cliff question that we heard. But, you know, throughout this entire news conference, there was a slightly different – now, maybe we're imagining this. We can't really prove it. It could be kind of subjective. But it seemed to me there was just a degree of difference about the way the president handled certain kinds of questions, perhaps personified by the very last question, which was shouted out after he had said thank you and started to leave, and which he listened to and smiled and said, that's a good question, but it would set a bad precedent for me to answer a question after I've finished and you shouted that out, and he left the stage. How many times do you think he's wanted to do exactly that with shouted questions at the end of news conferences throughout his entire political career? He finally did it today.
Actually, he almost always does just ignore the shouted question and walk out. It's very, very unusual for him to even stand there long enough and smile and respond to, as he did with Hans Nichols of Bloomberg there.
Scott Horsley, he talked again several times about wanting to immediately, he said, we can do it next week. We can get an agreement to guarantee no tax rise for those, is it $250,000 and under? And that would take care of half the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, he proposed this actually, you know, going back before the election and last week, and he repeated it today. It's not going to happen. I mean, the Republicans are not going to give up the only leverage they have, which they would do if they were to decouple the high-end tax cuts from everybody else's tax cuts. But this is a good way for the president to say, look, if we don't make a deal and everybody's tax rates go up, you know whose fault it is. It's the Republicans who wouldn't agree to my reasonable compromise. And so he kind of stakes out the moral high ground. But as Ron says, he did leave the door wide open there for the kind of compromise we're talking about. He said, you know, I'm open to new ideas. I'm not going to slam the door. And as long as the Republicans can have the fig leaf of not having to raise marginal tax rates, there really is, I think, some common ground that could be arrived at here.
Interesting, Ron. He mentioned that there are more people who agreed with me on tax cuts for the rich than voted for me.
Yes, it was about 60% of the exit polls were okay with that idea. If you combine those who said, yes, taxes should go up on the rich only, with those who said, you know, taxes really ought to go up to some degree on everyone. If you combine those two responses, you get 60%. And he only got a little over 50%. So yes, in a sense, tax increases for at least the rich were more popular than he.
Yeah, another way to put that, 40% of Mitt Romney's supporters think taxes should go up on at least the wealthy or everybody.
Wow. Tom Bowman, right up top in the news conference, the president was asked about the ongoing investigation, I guess, into his now retired CIA chief, General David Petraeus. He was asked, was there a breach of national security or classified information? What did he say?
Right. The president said at this point there's no evidence there was a breach of national security, there was a leak of any classified information. He reiterated that General Petraeus served with great distinction, both in the military and at CIA, and the United States is a safer place because of what Petraeus did in his service. Interestingly, he was asked about should he have been informed earlier by the FBI about this investigation. He was, of course, informed fairly recently about it after the investigation was over, and he kind of dodged it. He said, well, the FBI has a protocol for how they handle these things. You know, they don't want to have any political meddling in their investigations. And then he was pressed on it further, and he said, I'm withholding judgment about this. Basically, go call the FBI. We'll look into this issue of when people should be notified. But he did say he has confidence in the FBI. And, you know, again, he reiterated again that at what point should politicians be informed of criminal investigations, and there's a potential there of interfering with investigations.
Right. He said we're not supposed to meddle with these things.
Absolutely.
And that's been our practice. And he also was pressed again. He was asked, are you withholding judgment about a security breach? And he basically said yes.
Yeah, he's withholding judgment. They continue to investigate this issue. Paula Broadwell, the woman who was having an affair with General Petraeus, they've removed boxes of documents from her home in North Carolina and also one of her computers. This investigation is ongoing, and the issue now is, did she have classified information that she shouldn't have had?
He was also asked about this call by Senator John McCain and some others for Watergate-style hearings on the attacks on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, this past September 11th, when four people, including our U.S. ambassador there, were killed. And then this led to Susan Rice, currently the U.N. ambassador, who's talked about as a potential next Secretary of State. We've had Senator Lindsey Graham come out and say he doesn't trust her because of what she said about the attacks on Benghazi, saying they were not a terror-related. And we heard quite a passionate defense of her from the president.
Yeah, this was probably the strongest language we heard from the president. He said, look, if you want to pick on Ambassador Rice, you know, because you think she's maybe an easy target, you're really picking a fight with me. She was speaking what was at that time the intelligence community's line. She went on the Sunday talk shows the Sunday after the Tuesday attack, and as we now know, because the intelligence community has backed her up on this, she was just giving the talking points that had been given to her, which at that point were that the attack in Benghazi had begun as a reaction to that anti-Islamic video and then sort of morphed into something more sinister, but was not a pre-planned terrorist attack. The views of what went on in Benghazi had evolved since then.
Well, it was very awkward that day because we also had the president of Libya actually telling NPR that he thought it was a terrorist attack.
That's right. But Ambassador Rice was giving what at that time was the company line. She wasn't speaking on her own behalf. She wasn't somehow acting out of bounds. And the president basically said to Senators Graham and McCain, if you want to pick on somebody about what the intelligence community was saying at that time, come after me. Don't go after Ambassador Rice. Now, he didn't go so far as to say he was going to tap her as Secretary of State.
Right.
He ducked any sort of personnel questions. But he said, look, if I decide she's the right person to be Secretary of State, I'm going to nominate her. And sort of putting the Senate on notice that, again, I just won re-election and I'm not going to be pushed around by the likes of Lindsey Graham and John McCain.
Right. Yep. Go ahead, Ron Elving.
Just wanted to say that Hillary Clinton, the current Secretary of State, has pretty much made it clear that she would like to move on, that she doesn't expect to do this job in the second term. This is not disapproval of her on the part of the president that they're talking about other people taking over that job. More or less at the end of a first term, everybody's name is kind of on the table, and whether or not people are going to stay in cabinet jobs is kind of an open question. But many times they make it clear they're going to move on. They're going to make other plans and have other things they want to do, and Hillary Clinton has done that. So the question of who's going to be at state is an open question, which is why Susan Rice comes up.
Right. Ron Elving, we heard—
By the way, yes, it might not be in the Republicans' interest to to wage a battle against a woman nominee for a powerful cabinet post.
Scott Horsley, politics all the time. Tom Bowman, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, on Benghazi, the reporter stayed on Benghazi and mentioned the fact that some of the families said one of their sons who was killed at the Benghazi attack, one of the CIA contractors, their son didn't get the help he needed. Basically, he died as a result of that. President said, listen, we did all we could. My number one priority is to protect Americans. After the attack, he immediately ordered all sorts of help to head toward Benghazi. That is true. They moved troops from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They moved troops from Europe toward Benghazi. They did not get there in time. One of the key questions in the investigation is, why wasn't there some sort of a quick reaction force that could get to Benghazi quickly? That's the whole reason of having a quick reaction force. You can't have a quick reaction force that comes from the United States to Africa. They did get help from the embassy in Tripoli, some CIA contract guards, and some special operations forces moved toward Benghazi, did not get there in time to help in the consulate, did get there in time to help on the attack on the annex and probably save some lives there. But one of the key questions is, why didn't African Command have a quick reaction force that they could send there immediately? The other issue, of course, is why wasn't there more security at this consulate? Why did this whole thing go south pretty quickly? Why did you lose the ambassador? Those are still very much key questions here.
And, Tom, do you think we will see some kind of more extensive hearings on this?
Well, the president dodged that issue. He said the investigation is ongoing. There's this blue ribbon panel, State Department panel, including Admiral Mullen, former the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is on it. They're expected to report on this, I believe, next month. But there could be rising calls in Congress beyond Senator McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham for some sort of a special Watergate-style look into what happened here.
Ron Elving, we also heard another topic that the president seemed very clear that he will be moving ahead on, immigration.
That's right. And the president knows perfectly well that if you look at the battleground states that he won, in most of them, he depended on the vote of Hispanics to put him over the top. And that is a remarkable thing for any American president to be acknowledging at this stage in our history, that this vote, which was the only really large demographic group that went up for Barack Obama in this election, has a fairly clear agenda. They would like the DREAM Act passed, at least the ones who voted for Barack Obama would, and they would also like a comprehensive approach to immigration reform. There are a number of Republicans who would also like to see that go forward so as to take this issue back into neutral territory between the two parties before we get to another presidential election or even a midterm election in 2014. So this is a propitious time. It's a perfect time. And the president has a kind of mandate to go forward on this that he simply did not have in the first term, although there is debate about that particular point. He clearly determined that the time to do immigration reform in a comprehensive way would be in a second term, and now the door is open.
And we hear so many Republicans now talking about it suddenly.
Yes, well, and some who have been in the past as well. I mean, John McCain, to be fair, was one of the people who back in the previous era, previous decade, was one of the architects of a comprehensive immigration plan. Now, he backed off it when he was the nominee of the Republican Party in 2008, right. But at one time, he was one of the movers and shakers.
And briefly, Scott Horsley, looking ahead, the president said he's going to meet with congressional leaders of both parties later this week.
That's right. He meets with them on Friday, just before he sets off on his quick trip to Asia. Then, you know, that they have about 4 weeks to actually make a deal.
So we can all get our holiday shopping in, which the president said would be impacted if we go over.
And he's got to try to squeeze in a meeting with Governor Romney in that period as well.
That's right. Thanks to Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, and NPR's Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman. Thank you all.
Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the first post-election press conference with President Obama at the White House. Stay with NPR News for the latest news on that and everything else. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.